On August 11, IRMEP's Center for Policy and Law held a briefing. The original live conference call and questions begin at slide number 9, and we also add slides with information responding to questions at the very end of the presentation. Welcome to that briefing, Lawsuit Aims to Block U.S. Aid to Israel. My name's Grant Smith. I'm the founder and director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, D.C. I'm also the plaintiff in this and other related lawsuits. A PDF file was sent out with numbered slides. I work off that deck. Questions were sent in by email. The very first one came from Leslie asking about the location of the complaint and exhibits. Those can be found at irmep.org/CFP. Other questions came in to our email address at info@irmep.org. Those questions were read, and response slides are included at the end. The Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy is a 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit organization founded in 2002 to study how U.S. Middle East policy is really formulated. And that involves research into major drivers such as interest groups and lobbies, their financial flows, in order to understand relevant history and activities. We dedicate a lot of resources to unearthing classified government information, and we're heavily reliant on sunshine laws to get information out to our growing ecosystem of stakeholders. And so our motto is research, awareness, and accountability. And the order of those words reflect our process flow, but also, as it turns out, vulnerability. My educational background is a product of Minnesota universities. Professionally, I've been doing primary and secondary research, mostly for the private sector. I've been in the business of analyzing and using research to create positive change for many, many years, working both in the United States and other countries. My books about policy formulation, major influencers, and results cover the neoconservative movement, the birth, escape from regulatory oversight, and growth of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, related lobbying and incidents involving espionage, including questionable activities to pass the U.S.'s very first free trade deal, and a history of nuclear diversion from the U.S. to Israel, including the current state division of labor and trajectory of the many individual Israel affinity organizations that make up the Israel lobby. The latest study goes deep into that topic of the ecosystem of Israel affinity groups, covering 336 organizations, when they came onto the scene, their areas of specialization, their tactics, weaknesses, and how they impact U.S. Middle East policy. This book is available on Amazon.com in Kindle and paperback, and also the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, Middle East Books and More, at MiddleEastBooksAndMore.com. The 135-page complaint was filed on August 8 in the District of Columbia District Court. All 9 defendants were served on August 10. This case is related to 3 other cases with the same plaintiff. The first related lawsuit obtained an unclassified 1987 Department of Defense report with details about Israel's clandestine nuclear weapons program. Israel provided those details in hopes that the Reagan administration would deliver SDI contracts to Israeli industry, that is, Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars contracts. And the Department of Defense fought hard to keep that report under wraps. The Weekly Standard complained bitterly when it was released, claiming the Obama administration was undermining long-standing agreements with the State of Israel. Case 22-4 of 2015 seeks all CIA files about the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade uranium from a contractor in Pennsylvania to Dimona in Israel. Though ongoing, a partial victory in this case resulted in classified files being released, but we seek thousands of operations files known to have existed that are releasable because of the CIA Information Act of 1984, which does not let the agency retain files if there was an investigation of the CIA for improprieties in this case, the Justice Department, Congress, and the White House all investigated the CIA to determine whether there was an improper diversion as a clandestine operation. That alone makes the files releasable. And finally, the simplest of the three cases, 1431, seeks the top line number for the past years of CIA intelligence support to Israel. We're trying to get the overall budget number to understand that something the president has alluded to is unprecedented, but which has never been publicly released. So the timing of this new case and the larger context mean we're going to be very accelerated in our approach to hearings and motions. The defendants named in our lawsuit in alphabetical order by last name include John Brennan, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Ashton Carter, director of the U.S. Department of Defense, John Kerry, Secretary of State, Jacob Lew, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Treasury, Ernest Moniz, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Energy, President Obama, and Penny Pritzker, who is Secretary of the U.S. Department of Commerce. That may seem like an unusual list of agencies listed in a very different kind of lawsuit. Until you read the first 33 pages of the complaint, what all these defendants have in common and what all their agencies have in common is further entrenching, particularly during this administration, a policy that we claim is unlawful. This activity has been in order to benefit U.S. foreign aid to Israel at great cost to existing arms export controls, transparency, and accountability, as well as America's reputation. We now join the conference call briefing as originally recorded.
These activities have also quantifiably injured both the plaintiff and many other parties, not least of which are U.S. taxpayers. So, from a statutory perspective, the lawsuit alleges violations of the Administrative Procedure Act, including major violations of the Freedom of Information Act, which is where we've traditionally filed most of our complaints, the Take Care Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and it seeks further release under 28 U.S.C. 1361, compelling government officials due performance of their duties. On slide 10, we list what this lawsuit is really about. It's really about presidential overreach. It's about structural limits of the U.S. Constitution, our rights as the public to understand the functions of government, the rights for informed petition for redress. Few of these things have been available under the long-standing commitments that we're going to explore. The context here is very important. Slide number 11. Right now, there's a bit of a hurry, since this lawsuit explicitly seeks to impact U.S. foreign aid to Israel. In short, we hope to block it. As many of you probably know, the administration and the Israeli government are negotiating a new 10-year MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, that will serve as the basis for fiscal year 2019-2028 U.S. foreign aid to Israel, which some news reports claim could increase to $4 to $5 billion per year. And although there's some information trickling out of the negotiations that the Obama administration has tried to limit the amount of U.S. foreign aid that will go directly into Israeli military industrial programs and seeking to limit Israel's ability to constantly seek ad hoc aid from Congress above and beyond any signed MOU, which is habitual at this point. There are many reports that the final deal will be inked this month. Slide 12. Congress will soon pass, and the president will soon sign into law the final installments of the current fiscal year 2009-2018 foreign aid package. Fiscal year 2018 begins in October. So there's already legislation in the House, which by all indications will be much more than the $3.1 billion final payments due under the existing MOU. This aid is usually advanced under very preferential treatment in a way that allows Israel to obtain its cash from the treasury and even earn interest on the aid until it's actually dispersed. So there is urgency around the question of impacting aid to Israel, since challenges to its legality may indeed become moot as soon as the cash starts flowing. And there's a major drive to start that cash flowing. Slide number 13, which has a beautiful graphic of American-Israel Public Affairs Committee petitions. This is the organization which lobbies Congress on behalf of major Israel affinity organizations. It's gathered a war chest of donations and member petitions returned to AIPAC that AIPAC will then deliver to their members of Congress and senators to press for fast passage of final year 2018 aid and support for the new MOU. So AIPAC's been gathering these donations and targeted petitions across the country and is ready to go. And I think it's interesting to note, as many already have, that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who mustered all of his U.S. and Israeli allies in an attempt to block the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, has now made a calculation that he's more likely to get a better aid deal with the outgoing Obama administration than whoever next occupies the White House. So this is interesting from the standpoint of Americans, the idea that a president is giving priority treatments, again, the request from the primary source of opposition to this deal with Iran, the idea that he will be possibly saddling his successor, not knowing for sure who that might be, with such an immense obligation on taxpayers. So it would seem strange that given the fact that waiting is certainly an option, that the Obama administration is reportedly rushing with the Israelis for the finish line to pass a deal this month. On slide 14, which doesn't have a slide number, in perspective, adjusted for inflation, this is a chart, purple, the United States has delivered $250 billion in publicly known foreign aid to Israel since 1948, and that includes an inflation-adjusted $1 billion the year right after it was founded. This is more foreign aid than the U.S. has given to any other single country. And Israel, despite its relative wealth, continues to be the top aid recipient. So this is what we know about from Congressional Research Service reports. But another key question, and certainly covered by questions raised in this lawsuit, is how much classified U.S. foreign aid is going to Israel? Well, the fact is it seems to be a great deal. And Ronald, I'll get to your question at the end. It's a good question. We don't know how much more foreign aid is funneled to Israel as intelligence aid. Obama stated at an address a year ago at American, President Obama, a year ago at American University, that he was delivering military and intelligence assistance at unprecedented levels. So what does that mean if we know, again, from slide 14, what the unclassified amounts of aid are? How much does that leave for intelligence aid? Well, if the president adjusted for inflation, is it 1.9, or didn't adjust for inflation, $1.9 billion? Or did he adjust for inflation and account for the previous high inflation-adjusted aid figure of $16.3 billion, and provide $13.2 billion in additional secret intelligence aid? We don't know. That's classified. And again, that's one of the data points, top line budget numbers that we're seeking in a related case that is currently unfolding. We think the public should know the top line budget number, and again, hope that that lawsuit, that separate lawsuit, managed to dislodge it. The core claim in this lawsuit is that the Symington and Glenn amendments to the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 are being violated. These laws prohibit U.S. foreign aid to any non-nuclear, non-proliferation treaty, any non-nuclear non-proliferation treaty, non-NPT treaty signatory, that is building up a nuclear weapons program, transferring technologies from other countries, transferring the related technologies to other countries. So these laws specifically require the U.S. president to stop giving aid when these sorts of activities are uncovered, issue waivers explaining why, publicly, why it is in the U.S. national interest to continue delivering such aid if such activities are uncovered. And we have some of the exact language on slide 16. The original law, as passed, is in the exhibits of the complaint. So it essentially requires the U.S. to prohibit or issue special waivers on aid to any non-NPT signatory building up a nuclear weapons program. The legislative intent of the Symington Act is clear, and although this has been amended many times, the law is still on the books, 22 U.S.C. 2799A-1. Titled Nuclear Reprocessing Transfers, Illegal Export for Nuclear Explosive Devices Transfers, and Nuclear Explosive Devices and Nuclear Detonations. That's kind of a mouthful. But the legislative intent, as stated in committee reports by Senator Stuart Symington, is, quote, "If you wish to take the dangerous and costly steps necessary to achieve a nuclear weapons option, you cannot expect the United States to help underwrite that effort indirectly or directly," unquote. A very clear statement of legislative intent. What's also very clear is that although Israel has never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it's clearly a non-NPT nuclear weapons state subject to these restrictions. There's abundant information that is now in the public domain. It grows every year about Israel's nuclear weapons program. There's even more classified information that U.S. officials can access and act upon. So the question is, why don't they? Slide 19 certainly include, and this is by no means a complete list, Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli who used to work at Dimona, who smuggled photos out of the nuclear weapons developments going on in that facility in Israel. The London Sunday Times published them in 1986. In 1991, investigative reporter Cy Hirsch published the Samson option, incredible, groundbreaking expose of the development of Israel's nuclear weapons. 1999, Abner Cohen, Israel and the Bomb. He's also written books and articles, many, some cited in the lawsuit, about the policy of nuclear ambiguity, nuclear opacity that Israel has promoted around its nuclear weapons program, and specifically not talking about it. In 2008, former President Jimmy Carter claimed Israel had 150 weapons, a report published in the Times of London. In 2010, New York Times editor Sasha Polakow-Saransky published secret apartheid-era documents in his book, The Unspoken Alliance, about Israel's efforts to sell nuclear weapons to apartheid South Africa. And finally, another groundbreaking book by Dr. Roger Mattson, Stealing the Bomb, all about Israel's clandestine activities, particularly focused on the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, which resulted in the discovery that weapons-grade uranium from a Pennsylvania plant intended for Navy contracts somehow ended up at Dimona. That book and classified information releases that have come out are extremely interesting. Many curious visitors went to a plant which had a board of directors and leadership of many Zionist Organization of America executives. Those top spies included Israel's Rafael Eitan and his team, who were invited in by NUMEC President Zalman Shapiro, who just recently passed away. Mattson goes into even further new territory, explaining Eitan's role in gathering such material before and after NUMEC. And this was all a period before Eitan began handling spy for Israel Jonathan Pollard, who all just recently left prison. This is sort of an unknown history of Rafael Eitan's activities against the U.S. Slide number 21 is more information that's come out. Witnesses giving testimony about executives at NUMEC loading canisters of highly enriched uranium for shipment to Israel. This is testimony given to the FBI in 1980, very damning testimony, but which never had any impact on Symington and Glenn enforcement. So these are the activities, these are the problems that led to this plant, this is slide number 22, current star role on the Department of Energy's list of top losses of highly enriched weapons-grade uranium in the United States, either used as weapons or possibly as a booster fuel for Dimona, if you read Mattson's book. And there are other very good resources for exploring that still unfolding story in the final slides at the end of this presentation. As a countermeasure to this growing public information about and interest in Israel's nuclear weapons program, executive branch members and the executive branch have stepped up denials and tactics to block accountability. Probably the most famous is President Obama's response to veteran White House reporter Helen Thomas in 2009, asking her debut question of Obama, in which she inquired whether he knew of any country in the Middle East that possessed nuclear weapons, and he brushed her off by answering a lengthy response and analysis of Afghanistan, saying that he didn't want to speculate on the possibility of Israel having nuclear weapons. I mean, he didn't mention that. He just simply said, I don't want to speculate, and then moved on to a friendly reporter at the Huffington Post to ask him less explosive questions. There's a wonderful video documentary by Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy and Chris Belcher, the team as part of the Washington stakeout, ambushed executive branch members in a video documentary asking them about nuclear weapons program. All of them flee or obfuscate or refuse to answer. That link is so important that it appears here and in the resources at the final part of this slide deck. But the Obama administration has gone further. Before the Obama administration, the executive branch led by example whenever questions about Israel's nuclear weapons came up. They led by example, again, by ignoring, dodging, running away, rephrasing, all of the things you do when you don't want to answer a question. But the Obama administration has now essentially codified nuclear ambiguity in what amounts to a new gag law. We have sought full release of this gag order, its champions, and all related information about its development. But we've only received a single page, which was 90%. Redacted. But what remains is very illuminating. Since September 6, 2012, the Department of Energy has enforced and propagated this new gag law, over federal contractors and agencies. It's called Classification Bulletin WNP 136. It bears the rather Orwellian title, quote, guidance on release of information relating to the potential for an Israeli nuclear capability, unquote. And it cites as its authority U.S. Department of State Classification Guide 05D, which is actually a public document. So this is an Israeli-specific gag order, which has immense consequences. It also has an inherent contradiction. Because it's already in the public domain, the U.S. Department of State's classification guidelines, if you read them, it really implies that if properly invoked, federal employees will be encouraged to be more informative and not completely muzzled about Israel's nuclear program, its implications for proliferation, its implications for U.S. policy. It specifically states, quote, reporting on an analysis of internal affairs and foreign relations of a country is a central function of U.S. Foreign Service Post and is vital to the formulation and execution of policy. This reporting should be unclassified when the subject matter is routine, already in the public domain, and otherwise not sensitive. So this authority, which the Energy Department claims is behind its gag order, actually would encourage precisely the opposite behavior. And it's this suspicious reframing and passing of the gag order which has led us to conclude that it's really designed to thwart proper abidance of Symington and Glenn. Now, if you wind back to that question, about not classifying what's already in the public domain, slide 26 is a statistically significant Google consumer research poll that was fielded in 2014. Statistically significant population of American adults. And 63.9% of Americans, when asked the question, do you believe Israel has nuclear weapons, say yes. And that is quite compelling. This is not a secret. And it's why some very interested analysts, such as Paul Pilar, former high CIA official, jokingly refer to Israel's nukes as kumquats, as if you just can't call them what they really are. And it leads to extreme contortions at many think tanks that are supposedly at the forefront of looking at proliferation, like ISIS, which never seem to find the time to intensely dedicate their efforts toward what is an open secret. And it leads to articles with compelling titles such as The Secret That Is Not. Anyway, slide number 27, WPN 136, what is the impact of the gag law? The impact is serious. This is a guideline with real teeth. It acts as a deterrent. James Doyle, who worked at Los Alamos, a nuclear analyst, wrote about Israel's nuclear weapons program for a magazine in 2013. He submitted and had his material passed for review. But perhaps WPN 136 hadn't sufficiently propagated itself through the federal bureaucracy yet. And a congressional staffer, of all people, was upset when he read the article. It was referred for classification officials for a second review, and Doyle's pay was cut, his home computer was searched, and he was fired. So this is a gag law that has had a real impact. And essentially, from the standpoint of outside sunshine law public watchdogs, it has increased release delays, if not blocking them entirely. It's increased the number of responses that, hey, this file simply can't be located under mandatory declassification reviews. It adds, not that this is unique to questions about Israeli nuclear weapons, but it adds to statutory FOIA deadlines being ignored. outrageous claims in court, which is documented well in our case against the Department of Defense, outrageous claims during reviews of decisions to withhold information that should have been released long ago, refusal to pay damage awards when they lose, and, of course, declining public accountability. All of these things are the indirect ways that WPN 136, again, Obama administration gag law, has thwarted public accountability. So it's also what has given us standing. And although the complaint, and I'm getting some email questions still saying, is the complaint linked? And I'll check that in a moment. I thought it was linked to the resource page. I'll check. Standing. And we list examples in which WPN 136 and the broader policy of nuclear ambiguity that preceded it have made Sunshine Law requests almost impossible. The Department of Commerce demanded almost $7,000 for files, which went into great detail about Israeli front company importation of nuclear weapons technology illegally from the U.S. In a number of instances after 2010, these reveal that Symington and Glenn are not being enforced. $10,952.78 in costs and fees to pursue that unclassified Department of Defense report on the Israeli nuclear weapons program, which included hydrogen bomb information. DOD refusing to pay even after court orders, spurious actions, other injury related to ambiguity in particular and its effect on Sunshine Laws. So probably unexpectedly to the gatekeepers, this has caused a great deal of quantifiable injury. But what's been driving ambiguity and for how long? Well, it's been going on for a very, very long time. The Israeli government, the lobby indirectly, have been demanding it since the Nixon administration. They don't want a discussion of Israel's nuclear weapons. The history by Avner Cohen states, and the record states, that Prime Minister Golda Meir of Israel and U.S. President Richard Nixon struck a deal that Israel wouldn't advertise its possession of nuclear weapons and the U.S. would tolerate it. More recently, declassified documents reveal that the Nixon administration was really not wanting to be subject to a, quote, Zionist campaign to try to undermine, unquote, U.S. resistance to Israel going nuclear. They didn't want to have to withhold fighter jets and other things and state why they were doing it. So they wanted to stay in the good graces of the lobby. And that same impetus has continued, with the exception that since 1976, it hasn't been legal for a president to pretend not to know. And on slide 31, the vicious circle that this is set up in the United States is quite pronounced. Israel obtains, in the box on the right, 3 o'clock position, slide 31, obtains U.S. weapons it would otherwise have to buy, and certainly could buy, and offsets its nuclear program expenditures. 6 o'clock position, the Israel Affinity Organization ecosystem builds up a funding base, puts out the PR, puts out the policy support for aid, hypes the Iran threat, funds nuclear Israeli nuclear weapons programs, and even gives donors for all this tax deductions. Now, most people don't know much about the Weizmann Institute for Science and other organizations that receive funding but also work to develop nuclear weapons, but they certainly should know about that. 9 o'clock position. AIPAC aggregates all of this Israel Affinity Organization power and then lobbies for aid. It lobbies for passage of the MOU. And, of course, at the top of the heap, 12 o'clock position, elected officials receive Israel Affinity Organization support and related party campaign contributions. They ignore the readily available intel. They thwart export controls. They ignore public information. They thwart transparency, and they shovel over the foreign aid. So the victim of the vicious cycle is not listed here, but we can certainly talk about that in just a bit. But the very interesting aspect of all of this is the uncanny degree to which the annual revenues raised and spent by Israel Affinity Organizations appear to magically generate a matching grant paid to Israel by U.S. taxpayers. So in this chart, in green, we have Israel Organization revenue. And again, these are the 336 organizations in the U.S., claiming charitable purposes, social welfare purposes, that are gathering funding, and it's contrasted with the actual unclassified U.S. aid delivered each year in billions of dollars. So for $3.7 billion in Israel Affinity Organization revenue raised in 2012, you have $3.1 billion. It was more, $3.1 billion in MOU package aid for that year. It's on track to reach $6.3 billion in Israel Affinity Organization revenue. And the quote-unquote matching grant of USAID would be $6 billion. So collectively, these organizations, again, that place Israel's the promotion and advancement of Israel at the top of their objectives has a huge impact in the United States, and collectively they're the largest charity in the U.S. in terms of 501c3s, but many of them have long since shed any pretense of true social welfare functions that they stated originally gained tax-exempt status. Aid, when you ask the right question, the question with actual numbers in it, is not a popular expenditure to Americans. It's not supported by 61.9% of Americans polled in a Google Consumer Research poll fielded in March of 2016. This number is actually going up. The number who believe U.S. foreign aid is too little or much too little, 6.5%, much too little, 8.4%, contrasted with much too much, 32.5%, too much, 29.4%. So that's pretty lopsided, and it's pretty illuminating when you look at the vicious cycle and see that the only group that's really not having any impact on that cycle is the taxpayer, the American public. The only thwarting of popular will, as reflected by government activity in how taxpayer dollars should be distributed, is absent. And that is quite a feat. So the relief that we're seeking, slide 34, is ambitious, but I think doable. What are we asking for? Do we want the judge to review a raft of sunshine law cases that we've filed? No. Do we want back all of the money we spent and were unlawfully charged for documents as the government fought to protect even unclassified information for nefarious purposes? No. Do we want the Department of Defense to pay back what it still owes us? No. As the complaint concludes, we want the problem to be eliminated. Quote, nuclear ambiguity, says the final portion of the complaint, is the unlawful fulcrum the defendants and their predecessors have employed for decades to illegally hoist the lion's share of U.S. taxpayer foreign aid into the coffers of an unlawful recipient. talk about mixing metaphors. It indirectly injures Americans, such as the plaintiff who attempt to overcome it and expose the truth, but it indirectly injures American taxpayers. Therefore, relief is eliminating the fulcrum, that is, eliminating nuclear ambiguity.
We estimate that since 1976, the year that Symington came into effect, an estimated $234 billion, adjusting for inflation, has been transferred to Israel in the form of U.S. taxpayer-funded foreign aid, publicly in the forms of weapons and economic aid, and secretly in the form of intelligence aid. So the first injunctive and affirmative release named in the complaint seeks that the federal government, which is in active concert and participation in nuclear ambiguity, be restrained and enjoined from directly or indirectly dispersing further foreign aid to Israel. The second point is that U.S. foreign aid unlawfully provided to Israel since, in this case, 1978, be clawed back for disgorgement, either as a rebate to U.S. taxpayers or for use in what would be legal and legitimate purposes that actually serve the common good. Slide number 36, injunctive and affirmative relief. We're looking for a declaration that nuclear ambiguity and all of its manifestations in the form of continual misrepresentation, that is, lies of omission, gag orders, systemic violations of sunshine laws, and all violations of the Administrative Procedure Act and Take Care Clause of the Constitution to be unlawful. And we also want the court to, under a mandamus ruling, order the president to faithfully uphold Symington and Glenn amendments in the future.
To questions and answers, and then maybe right after we get to some of those, I can go over some of the resources, but I'm going to take just 1 second here, and if people want, you can certainly take a look at the three resource slides with the hyperlinks of various websites and videos and other information that's been referred to in this presentation. The hyperlinks should be active. You should actually be able to click them and go to a cited video. You should actually be able to get the information directly from the PDF file. And if anyone's had or not received that PDF file, you can certainly send an email to info@irmep.org. and request the PDF file. So with that, let me turn to some of the questions. And I guess the most important question, again, came in first. It was the question, where the heck's the complaint? Where can I download it? Don't make me go to Pacer and pay 30 cents a page to download the complaint. Yes, I hear you. If you go to IRMEP/CFP, you should now be able to download that full 135-page complaint and the exhibits that's on the website. And again, it's on the same page as all of the rest of the related cases. Ronald Johnson asks, how can it be fiscal year 2018 starts in October 2016? Good question. I'll go back to the slide and take a look at that. Someone else is asking, Mr. Web Skipper, I'm sure that's a real name, is linking to a Nation article, which is interesting. It's called, it's official, the Pentagon finally admitted that Israel has nuclear weapons too. And what Web Skipper is calling our attention to, if you Google that title, is one of the few what I would call mainstream media reports about some of these explosive, very tough to obtain information that we've obtained and circulated about the weapons programs and its policy implications. The Nation magazine won't touch an even more explosive revelation, which came from some FBI files. In 2014, antiwar.com published those documents on it's 2012, about a network of nuclear technology smugglers who had taken Krytrons and illegally shipped them to Israel. One of the reasons I think the media doesn't like that story is that one of the people named on the Israeli side of the smuggling network was none other than Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And so that presents a lot of challenges for reporters who have already got kind of a narrative on what the real problem is in the Middle East when it concerns nuclear weapons and nuclear technology proliferation. That story, FBI investigates Milco nuclear trigger smuggling to Israel, and the other one at antiwar.com was specifically titled, Netanyahu worked inside nuclear smuggling ring. So that's a pretty interesting article. Another question about the amounts of nuclear materials taken from NUMAC that were lost from NUMAC wants to know the unit of measure. And just to go back to slide 22, I believe it's kilograms. And yes, kilograms. So if you read the two books about this, one is Divert that I wrote, and the other Stealing the Bomb that Roger Mattson wrote, it's enough to make several gun-type nuclear devices or function as a booster fuel. Jeffrey asks, quote, other than an extensive report by Courthouse News Service, I've seen nothing in the mainstream press about your filing of this suit. And he's wondering if this is just an example of the kind of pressure that can be subjected to reporters who try to report this kind of thing. Well, I guess the answer is we'll have to see. I am very, very impressed with how well propagated the story is over Twitter, over Facebook, its appearance in the Google News Stream, the various websites that many, many more people gravitate toward when they're looking for discussions of these types of allegedly controversial news items, such as Mondo Weiss, antiwar.com, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess we may have to wait. We may have to wait. But again, some of the other lawsuits have had a little bit of traction, and we may well see some reporting in the near future. Who knows? The question comes in from Peter, who says, it is received wisdom that Israel is required under the annual FMF appropriations grants to spend about 3/4 or so of the grants on U.S. manufactured weapons and other material. I looked into this and found that there's no record of any public DOD, IG, GAO, CBO, or other audit or tests of whether, in fact, this happens. Do you have info concerning whether and how Israel's actual expenditure on U.S. defense contractors is monitored? Okay, Peter, I think one place to look is certainly the foreign military sales announcements by the Department of Defense. They're pretty accurate in terms of the appropriations and expenditures on and announced plans to purchase advanced jet fighters, which are, by the way, nuclear capable. And those foreign military sales bulletins, which you can find by Googling foreign military sales program, are pretty interesting because they kind of dispel the myth that a lot of this aid is just critical and big job-producing high-tech sales and exports. Now, first of all, it's not a sale, really, since we do, in fact, pay over tax dollars for all of this. But a lot of the purchases are things for, like, aviation fuel at $1.50 a gallon. You know, how much value added is there in refining aviation fuel and shipping billions of it over to Israel? Well, probably not much. And things for, you know, food purchases. So, you know, in terms of the high-tech impact and justifying this as just vital to America's economy, kind of dispels the myth of that when you look at a lot of these contracts for things like aviation fuel and food that are disclosed there. But anyway, Peter, I recommend that you check that out, the foreign military sales on the Defense Department's website. Okay, we're coming up to the end of the hour here. I want to thank everybody who joined in, took an hour out of their day to take a look at these issues. Thanks to Ron, Web Skipper, Jeffrey, Peter, and some of the others, Leslie, for sending in questions. Really appreciate that. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free to shoot those via email. At the very end of the slide deck, you can find some resource pages. And so the complaint, the exhibits are now up. The PDF is downloadable, 135 pages of information at earmap.org, CFP, the 2014 court case, the DOD report release, the 2015 court case win, CIA files on the new MECDA version and cover up, Sam Husseini, Chris Belcher's Washington Stakeout. The link is in the deck. Part two of the resource page, State Department Classification Guide 05D, some recent information on Nixon, ambiguity and fear of the Israel lobby as a driver for the ambiguity policy, the Google poll about do you believe Israel's nuclear weapons, and the survey link, Israel affinity organizations, the size, category, employees, forecast revenue, data formation can all be found on the israellobby.org/bigisrael page. Resources Part 3, U.S. Foreign Aid to Israel, obtained by the Federation of American Scientists, which gets it from the Congressional Research Service, which really doesn't like to release it, and they'll tell you flat out that they work for Congress and not the public. But anyway, the FAS people have gotten a hold of those, and they put them out. Very interesting. Again, not inflation-adjusted, only unclassified aid. An analysis, ongoing, running analysis, since 1985, of U.S. foreign aid to Israel, pro-Israel PAC giving by candidates, policy discussions, all at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs at WRMEA.org, and sites that will actually discuss these issues. Two of them, a couple of them are podcasts, the Scott Horton Show, which is offers an incredible array of speakers on Middle East topics in particular. Jeffrey Blankford's program, Takes on the World, which is out a couple of times a month, extremely interesting guests and analysis. The antiwar.com website doesn't shy away from discussion of proliferation. And, of course, the indispensable MondoWeiss.net. So I encourage you, like I do, to check out those sites if you're really looking for people who are doing the job that many establishment outlets just find they can't do. So with that, I want to again thank you for coming. And we started the audio a little bit late, but we might be able to put out an audio recording for reference if we got enough to be interesting. So you might want to sign up for the IRMEP.org email list, which is a periodic update. And if we do put out that audio, you'll hear the announcement there. That would have been at the bottom of the briefing announcements received by email. Okay, thank you very much, and talk to you soon.